Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll discuss natural burials at Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery.
It is historical, and humans have been doing this for all of human history, and it's modern in that it's eco-friendly, it's using the least resources possible, and it's protecting ecosystems in Florida that would otherwise perhaps be developed on.
We'll talk about Orlando Sentinel newspaper publisher Martin Anderson, who encouraged significant growth in Central Florida.
The Orlando Anderson encountered in 1931 was the largest interior city in Florida, with a population of 35,560. Its economy was defined by agriculture and tourism.
And we'll remember the heydays of Florida cracker horses and ponies in the 19th century. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the river at dawn.
The process of preserving bodies through embalming goes back thousands of years. The ancient Egyptians are known for their elaborate mummification process. The Chinchorro and Incas in South America also practice mummification. During the European Renaissance, from about 1450 to 1650, embalming was used mainly so that dead bodies could be dissected for scientific study. Dr. Thomas Holmes is known as the father of American embalming because he used formaldehyde and other chemicals to preserve bodies. Carly Zephrin is operations coordinator at Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery. She points out that modern embalming started in the 1860s during the Civil War.
Before that, most people just did natural burial on their own land if they were able, but embalming wasn't popular until it was needed to get soldiers home from the war. And then the process became widely available to the masses, and once the funeral home industry got involved and realized they could sell that service, it really boomed, and people were made to believe that they needed that in order to respect their loved ones.
Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery is located in southeast Gainesville between Micanopy and Hawthorne. It's on 93 acres that is part of the Alachua County Trust's 606-acre Prairie Creek Preserve, which is adjacent to the 21,000-acre Paynes Prairie State Park.
Essentially, it's a conservation effort to protect Florida's natural habitat, and in doing so, we are providing a natural burial service for people, which also helps to protect the land. So we conserve Florida's native habitats, we do ecosystem restoration, we do prescribed burns, we plant native seedlings, and on top of that, we are also a fully operational cemetery. So we dig our graves by hand, we involve the family in that process, or any loved ones that want to be a part of that process, they can help dig their loved one's grave, and they can also help with the entire burial service. Otherwise, we have a full staff and volunteers that help out with the pallbearing and the lowering and the filling in of the grave.
In addition to all graves being dug by hand at Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery, no embalming of bodies is permitted and no burial vaults or industrial containers are allowed. No grave markers are used except for a 2-inch brass disc that shows the deceased person's name, birth date, and death date. The grave sites are also marked by GPS. Carly Zephrin.
But essentially, we are a nature preserve, so our ecosystems are comprised of our oak hammock woods and our wildflower meadow. And folks can kind of pick between those two ecosystems of where they want to be buried. We give them a tour. We show the loved ones, around on behalf of their deceased loved one. And Pretty much from there, we involve either a funeral home or the family. If they choose to do a home funeral, they're welcome to care for their own dead and bring them to us at the cemetery. And the process is, once the body arrives, we load them onto our Amish-style burial cart and process out into the woods or into the meadow for their burial. And we are all manually caring for this body and lowering them into the earth and covering them back up, basically, and returning them to nature.
The Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery is in a hardwood forest that was formerly cattle grazing land. The cemetery works with the Alachua Conservation Trust to manage and protect the land as a wild space. People buried at the cemetery must be wrapped in a shroud or placed in a casket made of biodegradable material.
So most people either pick a shroud that's either cotton or any other organic material, or a pine box is a common choice. It has to be raw, untreated wood, so no chemicals or anything like that. Or a wicker casket is also a really beautiful option as well.
Although the primary focus of the Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery is on protecting the natural environment, the green burials done there are a return to historical pre-Civil War burial practices done in Florida and the rest of the United States.
It is historical, and humans have been doing this for all of human history, and it's modern in that it's eco-friendly, it's using the least resources possible, and it's protecting ecosystems in Florida that would otherwise perhaps be developed on.
There is currently an effort to create the Red Hills Community Cemetery as part of the 96-acre Hickory Preserve in northeast Leon County. The Red Hills Community Cemetery would be based on the successful Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery model. Carly Zephrin.
We've been around since 2010. That was the year of the first burial. It took 3 years, so starting in 2007, to get the ball rolling completely and getting the land surveyed. But yes, our first burial was in 2010, and we're operating at our max capacity today, doing about 2 burials a week. And we have over 1,300 people buried at Prairie Creek.
If you want a natural burial in Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery or the proposed Red Hills Community Cemetery, you can't purchase a plot as you would in a traditional cemetery. In the case of Red Hills, you can purchase a membership that secures your burial in the cemetery when the land is secured. Burial at Prairie Creek is first come, first served.
So we cannot actually take any pre-need reservations. We have limited space, so we are an as-need cemetery. And the fact that we're a nonprofit means we can't sell the plot to anyone. The only thing we can take money for is our burial service fee. So it's just that fee. There's no other expenses. And basically, when someone is either dying in hospice or has just passed, then they can start the process with us. And then we can work with their responsible party or loved one to get that site selected. And we're pretty much always ready to plan a burial in about 1 to 2 weeks at maximum. So as long as folks are willing to work with our timeline, we can get the ball rolling as soon as someone needs us.
Carly Zephrin is operations coordinator at the Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery in Alachua County. So put on your best, boys, and I'll wear my pearls. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, newspaper publishers played an important role in Southern urban and industrial development, the creation of the so-called New South, starting in the 1880s. Henry Grady of the Atlantic Constitution, Josephus Daniels of the Raleigh, North Carolina News and Observer, and Amon Carter of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram championed industrial development and/or questioned the more recent outcomes of urbanization and industrialization. Martin Anderson of the Orlando Sentinel and Orlando Evening Star followed in that tradition.
Martin Anderson, who published the Orlando Sentinel and the Orlando Evening Star from 1931 to 1967, epitomized the ambitious newspaper publisher and New South booster, according to H. Bailey Thompson, whose 2001 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly addresses a gap in the historiography between economic development in the New South and the Sun Belt, and the role of newspaper publishers in influencing political and economic power brokers. This University of Alabama professor of journalism spent some time as a reporter for the Orlando Sentinel and cited a 1984 Central Florida article that hailed Anderson as the man who built Orlando. Martin Anderson was born in Greenwood, Mississippi in 1897 and seemed to have newspapers in his blood. A newspaper carrier in his youth, he was a printer's assistant at Greenwood Commonwealth before advancing to the position of reporter. In the 1920s, he moved to Austin, Texas, where he became general manager of the Statesman and the American. In 1931, he arrived in Orlando and never left. As Thompson described him, Anderson's fierce blue eyes, large frame, and quick movements inspired respect and even fear among people. His editorials and front-page columns, written in a crisp, clear style, left no doubt where he stood on important issues. Thompson believed that Orlando and Anderson suited one another. Neither had strong attachments to any mythic past. The Orlando Anderson encountered in 1931 was the largest interior city in Florida, with a population of 35,560. Its economy was defined by agriculture and tourism. Miles of citrus groves and vegetable fields surrounded the city. Each winter, some 18,000 tourists enjoyed mild winter climate and the 31 lakes within the city's limits. Promoting the city's tourism with mail-away editions of the newspaper, sometimes printed with orange-scented ink, he soon became recognized as a formidable community advocate and leader. As he saw it, quote, "Newspapers create towns and states and prosperity and jobs for people," end quote. On another occasion, he wrote, quote, "I am attracted to newspaper people who devote the majority of their time and thought to supporting and publicizing the towns in which they live and which supports them. Newspapers build cities."
And although Anderson defined his role in a way that some might consider limited, he wielded considerable influence over development issues, especially in regard to road construction.
Indeed, he did. Thompson noted that, quote, "Anderson worried less about political principles than about keeping Orlando first in line for any largesse flowing from the public treasuries. Typically, his criterion in decision-making was whether taking one position over another would likely produce more growth. His pragmatism was most evident in his political endorsements," end quote. Three successful editorial campaigns illustrate this pragmatism: the creation of the State Road 520 shortcut to Cocoa, the rerouting of the Florida Turnpike closer to Orlando, and securing the Naval Training Base for Orlando. The Cross Peninsula State Road 50 that passed through Orlando connected the city to the Gulf and the Atlantic coast, but its terminus in Titusville left a lengthy drive to the developing area around Cocoa. Anderson launched his campaign for a cutoff by pointing to the generally poor road access to Orlando. Not a single road entering the city, except for State Road 50, enjoyed better than a poor rating. New north-south highways bypassed the city. Allocation of highway funds relied on a formula that distributed money equally across five districts. That formula ignored the disparity of growth rates. By 1954, Orlando's population had tripled since Anderson's arrival, with no reformulation of district funding. In 1954, the state held a gubernatorial primary election to fill out the term of Governor Dan McCarty following his untimely death. Anderson supported Charlie Johns in the three-way contest with Leroy Collins and Braley Oldham because Johns promised to support the Bithlow cutoff. Johns received 45% of the Orange County vote, but Collins ultimately became governor. Collins won Anderson's support in the 1956 election with two decisions. He honored Johns' pledge to build the Bithlow cutoff, and he supported the appointment of Billy Dial, a close ally of Anderson, to the State Road Board. State Road 520 opened March 17, 1956, and Dial championed Orlando's interests on the next big road project, the rerouting of the Florida Turnpike. The Florida Turnpike was originally designed to connect Miami and Jacksonville, roughly paralleling US 1. Created by the state legislature in 1953, the Florida Turnpike Authority had plans for the first 100 miles, but could recommend a more western route for the remaining roadway. Dial and Anderson proposed a route that would benefit Central Florida and would dovetail with the federal plans for an interstate highway system. With Governor Collins' support, the plan was approved and the work started in June 1955. With subsequent federal interstate construction on I-75 and I-95, Orlando became easily accessible by automobile by East Coast and Midwest travelers. With the addition of I-4, accessibility was a factor in the decision by Walt Disney to designate Orlando as the site for Disney World. By the 1960s, Orlando was experiencing boom times and led the nation in population growth. In 1963, the city had 342 industries that employed 83,000 workers. The following year added another 80 firms. The Orlando Sentinel prospered along with the city. The newspaper employed 700 full-time workers and had 135,000 subscribers in 13 counties.
Connie, road building clearly proved essential to economic growth, and Anderson's influence enabled that development, but obtaining a military training station implies influence on a national level. Orlando was a growing city in the 1960s, but the competition for a naval training station must have been fierce. What was Anderson's role in obtaining the base?
As we have seen before, Anderson's role centered on who he knew. From his early career in Texas, he knew Lyndon Johnson and was a supporter of his presidential ambitions as early as the mid-1950s. When Johnson ran for president in 1964, Anderson was all in. Anderson was concerned that Barry Goldwater, the Republican candidate, would defund the space complex at Canaveral and pushed for a visit to Orlando by President Johnson. On the evening of October 25, 1964, the president arrived, and Anderson was by his side throughout the visit. "I like Orlando," Johnson told a large crowd of supporters. "I can understand why Martin Anderson says it is a privilege to live in Central Florida." Anderson won the election and didn't hold it against the publisher that Orlando and Orange County gave its votes to Goldwater. The two met several times in the coming months at the White House. Johnson's support for Orlando as the site for the Naval Training Station was important, but required congressional approval. And there were several contending sites, including Pensacola. In November 1964, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara announced the closing of the Orlando Air Force Base, along with 90 other bases around the country, and the transfer of Sands Point Training Services Center to Orlando. News of the naval facilities coincided with the presentation of the Orlando Area Chamber of Commerce's John Young Award to Anderson on December the 6th. A telegram from President Johnson praised the publisher. "The esteem expressed for you by the citizens of Orlando reflects the value I have always placed on our friendship," he said. Anderson sold the Orlando Sentinel to the Chicago Tribune in 1965 and made plans for his 1967 retirement, saying, "The time to quit is when you're a winner, when you're ahead." If Anderson left in a hail of praise, the 1970s began a long period of reflection on what unregulated growth meant. Indeed, Jane Healey won a Pulitzer Prize for her Orlando Sentinel editorials, deploring the area's failure to manage growth wisely. As Thompson notes, quote, Martin Anderson was a quintessential American success story, brilliant, self-made, ruthless, and bold. He demonstrated a single-minded ambition to own powerful newspapers and through them to build a great city. But while Anderson retired to the accolades of his fellow boosters, his successors in Orlando have had to struggle with what has become a familiar problem in booming Sunbelt cities, too much success.
And Connie, for better or worse, I guess the most influential days of newspapers and newspaper men like Anderson are in the past. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Florida cracker horses are descended from livestock brought here by the Spanish in the 1500s. Also called the Seminole pony or marsh tacky, cracker horses and ponies were uniquely qualified to herd cattle in Florida in the 19th century. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Dr. Hannah Lipsey is a visiting assistant professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. She recently delivered a presentation titled Florida Ponies, Drivers of the Frontier in Fact and Fiction. As she did during her presentation, Dr. Lipsey begins with a short tale from the late 19th century about a 12-year-old boy named Trey Moore and his cracker pony, Bob.
The pony was a little bit disheveled when he first got him coming from these cracker cattlemen, but with proper care, kindness, and time, the boy soon loved him. They became inseparable, hunting cattle in the scrub. But the pony had a bit of an independent streak. As the narrator described, Bob dearly loved a frolic. The horse would often escape, giving chase, even after a hard day's work. After about 2 years together, the family left the homestead to take a plantation job. And on the journey, the boy and Bob went for a hunt. Fortunately, they became lost and fell into a sink. As they're falling, the boy clung to Bob. And finally, through the water-filled tunnel, they came to an opening. The boy left Bob to go explore. Bob, to his own devices, fell into quicksand. In heartbreaking prose, this author describes that a bullet was indeed kinder than suffocation. Eventually, the boy made it out and reunited with his family to recount the tale. And he ended with this idea that he's had other horses before, but none could ever replace the boyhood love for his little cracker pony, Bob. So this tale highlights this larger theme of using horses as a lens to view the romanticization of Florida during the 19th century. And you have one of these tales that actually names the horse, and it's Bob. You know, everyone knows a Bob, whether it's an animal or a human. You know, so you can really connect with this bond that this boy made with this little cracker pony.
The Florida pony, also known as the Florida cracker horse, traces its roots to the 16th century, when the Spanish brought them in their conquest of Florida and the New World. Over time, the pony evolved, developing unique features such as a narrow body and smaller hoofs to adapt to the Florida environment. By the 19th century, Florida settlers domesticated the species for their practicality in cattle herding.
So one of the things that Floridians did, or transplants, people who moved to Florida did, was they did cattle herding, cattle farming. This time they would do cattle roundup. Scrub cattle were loose essentially, and cattlemen would capture them up, would brand them. And one of the ways that they were most successful was using horses. And the Florida ponies, they're very agile and they seem to do better than these northern transplants.
Beginning in the 1930s, the population of Florida ponies diminished as large cattle herds from out west require larger horses to handle.
Eventually, by the 1930s, we see other horse breeds take over. So the cracker horse or the Florida ponies continue to be domesticated and widely used up until about the 1930s, when scrub cattle and larger cattle from out west were becoming infected by ticks and screwworms. And this led to some changes in the cattle practices. You now need larger horses, essentially, to handle the larger cattle that were coming from out west. And the seemingly smaller Florida ponies just were being replaced. So you have this slow demise of the Florida ponies from this 1930s larger cattle coming in. As those Florida ponies are being taken out and not as popular, there's less of them. So by the 1970s, only a few remained. And by the 1980s, a few Florida families came together to help preserve the breed, and they did intentional breeding of these horses. And there's actually a few feral herds. So when you mentioned reintroduced, Payne's Prairie Preserve State Park, north central Florida, just a little south of Gainesville, there's a herd that was reintroduced in the area in the mid-1980s. I say reintroduced because that land has actually been traced back to Spanish cattle lands, where the ancestors of these Florida ponies may have roamed.
Despite their decline, the romanticization of the Florida cracker horse remained. A comparison between the 19th century short tale that Dr. Lipsey opened this segment with and Patrick D. Smith's best-selling 1984 historical fiction novel, A Land Remembered, demonstrates this enduring idyllic view of the Florida pony.
We can even look at a real modern kind of novel, A Land Remembered. And more specifically, I look at this novel, The Student Edition, and we see a lot of similarities between how the Florida ponies are produced. In both tales, they're the boyhood companion. They're their friend in this frontier, and there's not a whole lot of humans around both of these families as they're trying to survive in the frontier. You see in the short tale, the family kind of seemed to give up on that and seemed to say, you know, this frontier homesteading isn't for me. Let's go and work at a plantation. Whereas at A Land Remembered, you see the successful Florida family in the frontier. And especially in The Land Remembered, the horse was instrumental. They had another horse that just wasn't as good. It was implied it was a Union cavalryman's horse. And it just wasn't great in the Florida scrub, in the Florida woods. But the smaller Ishmael, the smaller Florida pony, or marsh tacky as they call it in the book, was very agile and was very adaptable and helped the family be successful. So they're drivers of the frontier in the romanticism elements of it. It's a little bit of a pun because we drive horses. Horses were driven as part of their workload, but they're really this driver. They're part of this frontier living. They're part of this element of young adult fiction, agricultural endeavors. They're instrumental in contributing to this Florida 19th century as mythical, exotic, and rugged.
In 2008, the state of Florida designated the Florida pony, or Florida cracker horse, as the official state horse, further venerating and mythologizing the species in the annals of the state's past. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook at Florida Historical Society. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.